I reckon we've got enough to last, say, 3 weeks or so, and that with a tight belt and a light tooth, mind you. We've been a bit free with it so far. I don't know how long we shall take to finish, said Frodo. We were miserably delayed in the hills. But Samwise Gamgee, my dear hobbit, indeed, Sam, my dearest hobbit, friend of friends, I don't think we need give thought to what comes after that. To do the job, as you put it, what hope is there that we ever shall? And if we do, who knows what will come of that? If the one goes into the fire and we're at hand, I ask you, Sam, are we ever likely to need bread again? I think not. If we can nurse our limbs to bring us to Mount Doom, that's all we can do. More than I can, I begin to feel. Sam nodded silently. He took his master's hand and bent over it. He didn't kiss it, though his tears fell on it. Then he turned away, drew his sleeve over his nose, and got up and stamped about, trying to whistle, and saying between the efforts, "Where's that dratted creature?" It was actually not long before Gollum returned, but he came so quietly that they didn't hear him till he stood before them. His fingers and face were soiled with black mud. He was still chewing and slavering. What he was chewing, they didn't ask or like to think. "Worms or beetles or something slimy out of holes," thought Sam. "Brr, the nasty creature, the poor wretch." Gollum said nothing to them until he'd drunk deeply and washed himself in the stream. Then he came up to them, licking his lips.
"Better now," he said. "Are we rested? Ready to go on? Nice hobbits, they sleep beautifully. Trust Smeagol now? Very, very good."
The next stage of their journey was much the same as the last. As they went on, the gully became even shallower and the slope of its floor more gradual. Its bottom was less stony and more earthy, and slowly its sides dwindled to mere banks. It began to wind and wander. That night drew to its end, but clouds were now over moon and star, and they knew of the coming of day only by the slow spreading of the thin grey light. In a chill hour they came to the end of the watercourse. The banks became moss-grown mounds. Over the last shelf of rotting stone, the stream gurgled and fell down into a brown bog and was lost. Dry reeds hissed and rattled, though they could feel no wind. On either side and in front, wide fens and mires now lay, stretching away southward and eastward into the dim half-light. Mists curled and smoked from dark and noisome pools. The reek of them hung stifling in the still air. Far away, now almost due south, the mountain walls of Mordor loomed like a black bar of rugged clouds floating above a dangerous, fog-bound sea. The hobbits were now wholly in the hands of Gollum. They didn't know, and couldn't guess in that misty light, that they were in fact only just within the northern borders of the marshes, the main expanse of which lay south of them. They could, if they'd known the lands, with some delay have retraced their steps a little, and then, turning east, have come round over hard roads to the bare plain of Dagorlad, the field of the ancient battle before the gates of Mordor. Not that there was great hope in such a course. On that stony plain there was no cover, and across it ran the highways of the orcs and the soldiers of the enemy. Not even the cloaks of Lorien would have concealed them there. "How do we shape our course now, Smeagol?" asked Frodo. "Must we cross these evil-smelling fens?"
No need at all," said Gollum. "Not if hobbits want to reach the Dark Mountains and go to see him very quick. Back a little and round a little," his skinny arm waved north and east, "and you can come on hard, cold roads to the very gates of his country. Lots of his people will be there looking out for guests. Very pleased to take them straight to him, oh yes. His eye watches that way all the time. "It caught Smeagol there long ago," Gollum shuddered. "But Smeagol has used his eyes since then. Yes, yes. I've used eyes and feet and nose since then. I know other ways. More difficult, not so quick, but better. If we don't want him to see, follow Smeagol. He can take you through the marshes, through the mists, nice thick mists. Follow Smeagol very carefully, and you may go a long way, quite a long way, before he catches you. Yes, perhaps."
It was already day, a windless and sullen morning, and the marsh reeks lay in heavy banks. No sun pierced the low, clouded sky, and Gollum seemed anxious to continue the journey at once. So after a brief rest, they set out again and were soon lost in a shadowy, silent world, cut off from all view of the lands about, either the hills that they had left or the mountains that they sought. They went slowly in single file, Gollum, Sam, Frodo. Frodo seemed the most weary of the three, and slow though they went, he often lagged. The hobbits soon found that what had looked like one vast fen was really an endless network of pools and soft mires and winding, half-strangled watercourses. Among these a cunning eye and foot could thread a wandering path. Gollum certainly had that cunning and needed all of it. His head on its long neck was ever turning this way and that, while he sniffed and muttered all the time to himself. Sometimes he would hold up his hand and halt them, while he went forward a little, crouching, testing the ground with fingers or toes, or merely listening with one ear pressed to the earth. It was dreary and wearisome. Cold, clammy winter still held sway in this forsaken country. The only green was the scum of livid weed on the dark, greasy surfaces of the sullen waters. Dead grasses and rotting weeds loomed up in the mists like ragged shadows of long-forgotten summers. As the day wore on, the light increased a little, and the mists lifted, growing thinner and more transparent. Far above the rot and vapours of the world, the sun was riding high and golden now in a serene country with floors of dazzling foam. But only a passing ghost of her could they see below, bleared, pale, giving no colour and no warmth. But even at this faint reminder of her presence, Gollum scowled and flinched. He halted their journey, and they rested, squatting like little hunted animals, in the borders of a great brown reed thicket. There was a deep silence, only scraped on its surface by the faint quiver of empty seed plumes and broken grass blades trembling in small air movements that they could not feel. "Not a bird," said Sam mournfully.
"No, no birds," said Gollum. "Nice birds." He licked his lips. "No birds here. There are snakes, says. Worms, says. Things in the pools. Lots of things. Lots of nasty things. No birds," he ended sadly.
Sam looked at him with distaste. So passed the third day of their journey with Gollum. Before the shadows of evening were long in happier lands, they went on again, always on and on with only brief halts. These they made not so much for rest as to help Gollum, for now even he had to go forward with great care, and he was sometimes at a loss for a while. They'd come to the very midst of the dead marshes, and it was dark. They walked slowly, stooping, keeping close in line, following attentively every move that Gollum made. The fens grew more wet, opening into wide, stagnant meres, amongst which it grew more and more difficult to find the firmer places where feet could tread without sinking into gurgling mud. The travellers were light, or maybe none of them would ever have found a way through. Presently it grew altogether dark. The air itself seemed black and heavy to breathe. When lights appeared, Sam rubbed his eyes. He thought his head was going queer.
He first saw one with a corner of his left eye, a wisp of pale sheen that faded away. But others appeared soon after, some like dimly shining smoke, some like misty flames flickering slowly above unseen candles. Here and there they twisted like ghostly sheets unfurled by hidden hands. But neither of his companions spoke a word. At last Sam could bear it no longer.
"What's all this, Gollum?" he said in a whisper. "These lights! They're all round us now. Are we trapped? Who are they?"
Gollum looked up. A dark water was before him, and he was crawling on the ground, this way and that, doubtful of the way.
"Yes, they are all round us," he whispered. "The tricksy lights. Candles of corpses. Yes, yes. Don't you heed them. Don't look. Don't follow them. Where's the master?"
Sam looked back and found that Frodo had lagged again. He couldn't see him. He went some paces back into the darkness, not daring to move far or to call in more than a hoarse whisper. Suddenly he stumbled against Frodo, who was standing lost in thought, looking at the pale lights. His hands hung stiff at his sides. Water and slime were dripping from them.
"Come, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "Don't look at them. Gollum says we mustn't. Let's keep up with him and get out of this cursed place as quick as we can, if we can."
"All right," said Frodo, as if returning out of a dream. "I'm coming. Go on." Hurrying forward again, Sam tripped, catching his foot in some old root or tussock. He fell and came heavily on his hands, which sank deep into sticky ooze, so that his face was brought close to the surface of the dark mere. There was a faint hiss. A noisome smell went up. The lights flickered and danced and swirled. For a moment the water below him looked like some window, glazed with grimy glass, through which he was peering. Wrenching his hands out of the bog, he sprang back with a cry.
"There are dead things! Dead faces in the water!" he said with horror. "Dead faces!"
Gollum laughed.
"The dead marshes, yes, yes, that is their names," he cackled. "You shouldn't look in when the candles are lit."
"Who are they? What are they?" asked Sam, shuddering, turning to Frodo, who was now behind him.
"I don't know," said Frodo in a dreamlike voice. "But I've seen them too, in the pools when the candles were lit. They lie in all the pools, pale faces, deep, deep under the dark water. I saw them, grim faces and evil, and noble faces and sad, many faces proud and fair, and weeds in their silver hair, but all foul, all rotting, all dead. A fell light is in them."
Frodo hid his eyes in his hands.
"I know not who they are, but I thought I saw their men and elves and orcs beside them."
"Yes, yes," said Gollum. "All dead, all rotten. Elves and men and orcs, the dead marshes. There was a great battle long ago, yes. So they told him when Smeagol was young, when I was young, before the precious came. It was a great battle, tall men with long swords, and terrible elves, and orcs shrieking. They fought on the plain for days and months at the black gates, but the marshes have grown since then, swallowing up the graves, always creeping, creeping."
"But that's an age and more ago," said Sam. "The dead can't be really there. Is it some devilry hatched in the dark land?"
"Who knows? Smeagol doesn't know," answered Gollum. "You cannot reach them. You cannot touch them. We tried once, yes, precious, I tried once. But you cannot reach them. Only shapes to see, perhaps, not to touch. No, precious. All dead."
Sam looked darkly at him and shuddered again, thinking that he guessed why Smeagol had tried to touch them.
"Well, I don't want to see them," he said. "Never again. Can't we get on and get away?"
"Oh, yes," said Gollum, "but slowly, very slowly, very carefully, or hobbits go down to join the dead ones and light little candles. Follow, Smeagol, don't look at lights.
He crawled away to the right, seeking for a path round the mere. They came close behind, stooping, often using their hands even as he did. Three precious little golems in a row we shall be if this goes on much longer, thought Sam. At last they came to the end of the black mere, and they crossed it perilously, crawling or hopping from one treacherous island tussock to another. Often they floundered, stepping or falling hands first into waters as noisome as a cesspool, till they were slimed and fouled almost up to their necks and stank in one another's nostrils. It was late in the night when at length they reached firmer ground again. Gollum hissed and whispered to himself, but it appeared that he was pleased, in some mysterious way, by some blended sense of feel and smell and uncanny memory for shapes in the dark. He seemed to know just where he was again, and to be sure of his road again.
"Now on we go," he said. "Nice hobbit, brave hobbit. Very, very weary, of course. So we are, my precious, all of us. But we must take master away from the wicked lights. Yes, yes, we must."
With these words he started off again, almost at a trot, down what appeared to be a long lane between high reeds, and they stumbled after him as quickly as they could. But in a little while he stopped suddenly and sniffed the air doubtfully, hissing as if he was troubled or displeased again. "What is it?" growled Sam, misinterpreting the signs. "What's the need to sniff? The stink nearly knocks me down with my nose held. You stink, and master stinks, the whole place stinks."
"Yes, yes, and Sam stinks," answered Gollum. "Poor Smeagol smells it, but good Smeagol bears it. Helps nice master, but that's no matter. The air's moving. Change is coming. Smeagol wonders. He's not happy."
He went on again, but his uneasiness grew, and every now and again he stood up to his full height, craning his neck eastward and southward. For some time the hobbits could not hear or feel what was troubling him. Then suddenly all three halted, stiffening and listening. To Frodo and Sam it seemed that they heard, far away, a long wailing cry, high and thin and cruel. They shivered. At the same moment the stirring of the air became perceptible to them, and it grew very cold. As they stood straining their ears, they heard a noise like a wind coming in the distance. The misty lights wavered, dimmed, and went out. Gollum wouldn't move. He stood shaking and gibbering to himself, until with a rush the wind came upon them, hissing and snarling over the marshes. The night became less dark, light enough for them to see, or half see, shapeless drifts of fog, curling and twisting as it rolled over them and past them. Looking up, they saw the clouds breaking and shredding, and then high in the south the moon glimmered out, riding in the flying rack. For a moment the sight of it gladdened the hearts of the hobbits, but Gollum cowered down, muttering curses on the white face. Then Frodo and Sam, staring at the sky, breathing deeply of the fresher air, saw it come. A small cloud flying from the accursed hills, a black shadow loosed from Mordor, a vast shape winged and ominous. It scudded across the moon, and with a deadly cry went away westward, outrunning the wind in its fell speed. They fell forward, grovelling heedlessly on the cold earth. But the shadow of horror wheeled and returned, passing lower now, right above them, sweeping the Fenric with its ghastly wings. And then it was gone, flying back to Mordor with the speed of the wrath of Sauron, and behind it the wind roared away, leaving the dead marshes bare and bleak. The naked waste, as far as the eye could pierce, even to the distant menace of the mountains, was dappled with the fitful moonlight. Frodo and Sam got up, rubbing their eyes, like children wakened from an evil dream to find the familiar night still over the world. But Gollum lay on the ground as if he'd been stunned. They roused him with difficulty, and for some time he wouldn't lift his face, but knelt forward on his elbows, covering the back of his head with his large, flat hands.
"Wraiths," he wailed. "Wraiths on wings. The precious is their master. They see everything, everything. Nothing can hide from them. Curse the white face. And they tell him everything. He sees, he knows. Gollum, Gollum, Gollum."
It was not until the moon had sunk, westering far beyond Tol Brandir, that he would get up or make a move. From that time on, Sam thought that he sensed a change in Gollum again. He was more fawning and would be friendly, but Sam surprised some strange looks in his eyes at times, especially towards Frodo, and he went back more and more into his old manner of speaking. And Sam had another growing anxiety. Frodo seemed to be weary, weary to the point of exhaustion. He said nothing. Indeed, he hardly spoke at all, and he didn't complain, but he walked like one who carries a load, the weight of which is ever-increasing, and he dragged along, slower and slower, so that Sam had often to beg Gollum to wait and not to leave their master behind. In fact, with every step towards the gates of Mordor, Frodo felt the ring on its chain about his neck grow more burdensome. He was now beginning to feel it as an actual weight dragging him earthwards. But far more he was troubled by the eye, so he called it to himself. It was that, more than the drag of the ring, that made him cower and stoop as he walked. The eye, that horrible growing sense of a hostile will that strove with great power to pierce all shadows of cloud and earth and flesh, and to see you, to pin you under its deadly gaze, naked, immovable. So thin, so frail and thin, the veils were become that still warded it off. Frodo knew just where the present habitation and heart of that will now was, as certainly as a man can tell the direction of the sun with his eyes shut. He was facing it, and its potency beat upon his brow. Gollum probably felt something of the same sort. But what went on in his wretched heart, between the pressure of the eye and the lust of the ring that was so near, and his grovelling promise made half in the fear of cold iron, the hobbits didn't guess. Frodo gave no thought to it. Sam's mind was occupied mostly with his master, hardly noticing the dark cloud that had fallen on his own heart. He put Frodo in front of him now, and kept a watchful eye on every movement of his, supporting him if he stumbled, and trying to encourage him with clumsy words.